In the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. There's an awful lot of stuff to unpack in the lessons that we've had already this morning. So I'm going to try to weave my way through that, and you all are invited to attend. In the first lesson, we find Saul, a man very dedicated to finding and capturing people that he sees as a corrupt group of people who are defiling his faithful practice of worship and religion. They are referred to in the text as people belonging to the way. It seems as if he's pretty successful and pretty zealous in this work. In his own words, which are found later in the New Testament, he recounts being a part of the effort to find Stephen, a Christian. He does find him, and Stephen is found guilty of blasphemy, and Saul is a witness to the stoning of Stephen, who dies. Stephen is the first Christian martyr. In today's lesson, we find Saul headed to Damascus. His job, his mission, is to find more Christians to be persecuted. And as he's on his way, a light blinds Saul, and a voice says to him, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" Saul asks, "Who are you, Lord?" And the voice replies, "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting." Now, we're pretty fortunate here at St. Paul's. I mean, churches can have visual effects and visual aids and that sort of thing in worship, but how many times do you get a statue for that? So if you'll direct your attention to the statue of that man right there on my right, that's a depiction of Saul at the very time that his life is being interrupted by that blinding light. And I think the artist captures pretty well the expression of one who is suddenly stunned and confused, perhaps in awe, and certainly, this is transference on my part, he's very afraid, because I would be. The church I served in Wilkesboro, just prior to coming back and being able to join you once again, in that church, which is also named St. Paul's, there are two frescoes which were done by Ben Long. Now, this is an aside and not relevant to this sermon, but you might be interested in it. Ben Long is the person who really brought frescoes back to North Carolina and became pretty famous in the process, starting in Valley, up in West Jefferson with that church there. And he was the teacher of Roger Nelson, who was the person who painted the fresco here at St. Paul's. And Roger Nelson was involved in all the frescoes that Ben Long had done prior to the one he did here. Okay, that all that aside, let's say he's pretty good at this. There are two depictions of Saul and Paul, the same person, of course. One is the Apostle Paul in a prison cell with a pen in his hand and not paper, but what's the word, Fred?
Papyrus.
Papyrus or something like that. Fred knows everything. That's why we brought him today, because they knew I was preaching and would need help. So let's say it's papyrus. He's writing somebody. I bet he was writing the letter to the Corinthians. I don't really know. But the other one is really a more interesting picture, fresco. Because there is one of Saul being thrown from a horse. And the horse is falling as well, and it's a very kind of scary, disruptive, chaotic, frightful depiction. Now, while there are no mention of horses in the biblical accounts of Paul's encounter with Jesus, if you went online and looked for artists' depictions of this event, you would find a number of them have used horses. Perhaps it's because it makes the picture more interesting than just a guy standing there with a bright light blinding his eyes. I don't know. I was reminded of the title of a book by a fellow named Bill Doles, who, by the way, this is another aside, you'll get a lot of those today. It's called Filler. Don't you hate honesty? Anyway, this filler, Bill Doles, has a book out, and the title of his book is Just Because It Didn't Happen. And you look on the inside of the book, and it says, doesn't mean it isn't true. So whether or not there were horses there, no doubt it was a chaotic scene. It results, of course, as you know, in the complete reversal in the life of the Pharisee named Saul. The text has him blinded for several days and gradually regaining his sight after he meets a fellow named Ananias, who's had a vision to go and find Saul. Ananias is not dumb. He says, I don't want to do that. I mean, the text doesn't say that, but I know what he said. He said, I don't want to do that. This guy kills people, and he kills Christians, and I'm a Christian. I don't want to do it. God somehow in that vision assures him it's going to be okay. Go do it. He's faithful to that call, which I think is very, very scary. So he's sitting with the man who's a killer of Christians, and he lays his hands on him as he'd been instructed to do. Saul receives his sight. And after he's received his sight, he agrees to be baptized, and he's baptized. All of a sudden, literally and figuratively, he sees things in a completely new light. Saul has moved, you might say, metaphorically, from the realm of darkness to the realm of light. He has moved from being a persecutor to a believer. And he's moved from being Saul to being Paul. Interestingly enough, Paul is a pretty gutsy character. He immediately starts proclaiming his newfound faith to the very people for whom he has been working, and they don't appreciate him at all. So he's really caught between a rock and a hard place because his new community doesn't trust him. They're scared to death of him. And his old community is very mad at him for betraying them. And it seems like Paul's capable of that task as you follow his life through the New Testament. He is a pretty tough character. Okay, we'll shift gears and go to the gospel. We find Jesus on the beach. There are seven disciples, and they're out in a boat, and they're fishing. The text says, he says, children, you have no fish, have you? They reply, no. And he told them to move their nets to the other side of the boat, and suddenly they caught an abundance. John, who is in the boat, leans over and says to Peter, it is the Lord. Peter, always impetuous, jumps into the water. But wait, first, puts on his clothes and jumps into the water. Doesn't that sound weird? Well, it is weird. But once again, Fred Horton knows stuff. Peter is conscious of being in the presence of a divinity. And one does not enter the presence of the divinity naked. That was true in the ancient temple. The priest always had to be clothed to go into the Holy of Holies. When all are ashore, they see Jesus, but some are not really too sure who this person is. But the person has cooked some fish and has some bread. And it seems that after they ate their bread with Jesus, they began to recognize him. A lot is going on here. John is just full of signs and symbols. Obviously, when the abundance occurs of the catch, John perceives already, this is Jesus. This has happened before. Paul gets the notion. Not Paul, Peter. Peter and Paul, you get them mixed up. He receives that sign as well. And now, when they have broken bread with Jesus, they recognize him. Then Jesus takes Peter aside and asks him three different times, "Do you love me?" And Peter responds each time with, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you." And he says, "Feed my lambs," or "tend my sheep." The third time, Peter's pretty exasperated, and he says, "You know I love you." And Jesus says to him again, "Well, feed my sheep." These questions are, of course, a reminder to Peter of his three denials of Jesus. But more than that, Jesus presents these questions, I think, as opportunities for Peter to affirm three times that he is ready to assume what really will become a leadership role in a shepherding presence among those who are followers of the way of Jesus. Interestingly enough, the text today closes with Jesus' oft-repeated command, "Follow me." There's no question that Peter and Paul are the most visible, recognized early leaders in the development of what the prayer books calls that wonderful and sacred mystery that we call the church. And there are many accounts of their relationship because they didn't always get along that well or agree with one another. And so the church has been imitating them ever since. And that's okay. They also came together and stayed together. I believe, however, that if it were not for the witness of one woman, maybe none of this really would have come about. And that person is Mary Magdalene, the first proclaimer of the resurrection of Jesus, a woman who is mentioned in all four of the Gospels, which is very unusual. So I can see, because you're pretty sharp people, what you're already thinking, and it happens to be true, that the church was founded by Peter, Paul, and Mary. Look, you just got to do the material that you're given, and that was it. So here's the takeaway this morning. I've said this to you so many times, you're tired of hearing it, but it's the truth, and supposedly the truth can make you free. God uses the most improbable people God can find to do God's most important work. If God can use an extremely impetuous man who will deny even knowing the most important person in his life when the pressure's on, not once but three times, if God can use a man who zealously sought out Christians in order to have them executed, if God can use a woman who was once known to be possessed by demons, for the sake of all that is holy, if God can use these people to be founders of God's church, maybe, just maybe, God can use you. That's you I'm talking about. You and you and you, and even me. It's abundantly clear that God is much bigger and far more creative than our ability to conceptualize what God might be like. And God is going to surprise us no matter how much we think we know about God. God can use us, whoever we are, wherever we are, whatever we have done, or whatever we have left undone. God can use us. Did you notice this fact? Jesus appears to his disciples while they are at work. They weren't in a church. They weren't in a synagogue. They were at work. Jesus comes to Paul while he was, shall we say, on a business trip. God, Jesus, appears to Mary Magdalene as she is on her way to anoint the body of a dead man. Jesus meets these people where they are. And your office, or your place of work, or your car, or your wherever you are, whatever you're doing, does not exempt you from being possibly met by Jesus as well. Keep that in mind. The Right Reverend N.T. Wright, Bishop of Durham, England, says this: the question that has faced the world since Easter is the question that confronted Paul on the road to Damascus. Granted that a new transforming reality is let loose in the world, are we prepared to join in the song? The resurrection of Jesus is a new transforming reality in our world. And those who've somehow come in touch with that character and often didn't recognize him when he was there have been people who have changed the world for good. Jesus will meet us where we are and will say, I'm the way. There's truth in life in following the way. If you want to understand God, just follow me. I have a lot of work for you to do. The world needs you. The world needs you to spread my love, my peace. That needs to be spread to everybody with whom you come in contact, every day, everywhere, no matter where you are. Go and do. Amen.